You're listening to Synesthesia, produced live in the studio at Trent Radio 92.7 CFFF FM in beautiful Nungajuwanong, Peterborough, Ontario, every Thursday at 5 p.m. It's also a podcast on Soundproof, creative nonfiction for audio. I'm your producer and host, L.A. Alfonso. In this audio program, film theory meets film music. I'm in love with the genre of filmmaking, the self-inscribed film. When filmmakers use the camera, pen, to write their personal story cinematically. Once only in the realm of the avant-garde, it's now a ubiquitous way of making movies. As much as I could, I've been following the development of this genre since I became aware of it through the work of Chris Marker in the early 90s. Having seen only Hollywood films before, encountering Sans Soleil literally changed my life. The movie showed me a way to make films on my own, and it must have influenced somehow a pivotal point in the making of the student film, my student film, The Best Waitress in the World. It changed from the concept of documenting a waitress into making a film about my creative process. It was a switch from artifice to authenticity. I asked, why fake an audience? What's wrong with telling them that a film is being made? That's the truth. The filmmaker is always part of the story. The presence of the observer changes of the observed. Taking that into consideration, one must be upfront with the manipulation of sound and images. Yet, it's almost impossible to show the behind the scenes of editing. It has been attempted by filmmaker Orson Welles in his documentary F for Fake, where it was important to expose the lies. So, for a brief moment, the camera pulled back to show Welles in an editing suite. My attempt in my following film, trying to be some kind of hero, happened at the end. A trick I stole from the movie Wonder Boys, starring Michael Douglas. Mind blown. A new series on Netflix appeared on my feed yesterday. Blockbuster director David Fincher executive produced a series called Voir, and it's billed as a collection of visual essays for the love of cinema. Narrated in first person by scholars and cinephiles, it includes insights on character and craft and the cinematic moments that have long thrilled, perplexed, and challenged film lovers, says its official description. A deeper dive reveals that this series premiered in December of 2021, and I guess I'm a bit late to the game, but I am so grateful now to have made its acquaintance. Writer Peter Subsinski describes the show as a collection of six short films, each around 20 minutes in length, in which a collection of film journalists use a combination of artistic analysis, personal details, and judiciously selected clips in order to examine both the hold that the medium has held on our collective imagination for more than a century, and the ways in which it has evolved over time. Although Sapsinski acknowledges that this concept is no different from the countless number of similar videos one can find online, Voir has a big budget for production and clearances. With producer David Fincher's authoritative approval, his imprimatur of each episode, I cannot simply ignore the discovery of this mainstream example of what I want to do for my PhD. Voir has essentially given me a template that I can customize for my own content. I could even consider the project as an exercise in writing a spec script for the series. I could even consider the project as an exercise The artisanal nature of its creation is also a key difference. I am essentially the one-person cast and crew. This makes my effort a truly personal work. A work of art not dissimilar to what is found on YouTube on any given day, and my attention to the subject and the wealth of my personal archive is what sets mine apart. I learned a new word today from reading Susan Sontag, aleatory, an adjective that means depending on the throw of a dice or on chance, random. She was writing about Godard and his conviction that it is possible to absorb chance, using it as an additional tool for developing new structures, which extends beyond making only minimal preparations for a film and keeping the conditions of shooting flexible to the editing itself. She describes this as an openness to the aleatoric miracle. I had not read a description of my own philosophy in art and filmmaking in quite the same way before. Aleatory. This is similar to the way I produce this audio program. Without a predetermined or intentional soundtrack to any particular piece of writing that I read on air, even the words are put into some kind of blender. I go with the flow from a playlist I put together at the last minute. I wouldn't think about doing the creative juxtapositions that randomness can only provide. It requires an incredible amount of trust. But hear what's happening right now. I didn't plan this. J.P. Talat says, every study of the film genre, either explicitly or implicitly, begins from similarly problematic issues, concerns with what to include, art to exclude, and on what basis we can begin to make those determinations. So option one, postulate an essential nature for the form and go from there, which is an exclusive way of looking at it. Option two, work from the consensus of an accepted canon and compare and contrast to films that have been widely accepted as part of that canon, an inclusive way of looking at it. In Thomas Elsasser's paper, he notes that Frederick Kittler thinks it's the gramophone, not the cinematograph, that provides the basis for rethinking the modern discourse network of the human. Elsasser reminds us that Edison invented his kinetoscope, the precursor to the Lumiere cinematograph, after he had developed the phonograph. And he totally maintained that the kinetoscope would do for the eye what the phonograph had done for the ear, giving sound recording, also in respect to their combined function, priority over the mechanical recording of images. He quotes Kittler, writing had the monopoly on the storage of serial data up until the appearance of the gramophone. The gramophone empties out worlds by bypassing their imaginary aspect, the signifieds, for their real aspects, the physiology of the voice. In a filmed 2017 lecture from Spain, Elsasser says the notion of the silent film to sound is a false teleology. In his lecture, Elsasser says the main purpose of cinema as media archaeology is simply to do away with the very notion of predecessors and to break open this linearity with this history of cinema with many false teleologies. These include chronophotography to cinematography, silent to sound, black and white to color, and 2D to 3D. He says media archaeology was born out of a discontent with the canonized narratives of media culture. My own experience, I have developed a personal lived theory from decades of observing the development of the cinematic vocabulary for audiences to accept more readily a film utilizing the first-person perspective of the filmmaker. I can describe the incremental changes that I've seen in my own lifetime, but media archaeology, according to Elsasser, distributes history spatially, not chronologically. I think it would not only be interesting but useful to investigate cinematic self-portraits in first person with Elsasser's media archaeology in mind. What came before David Holtzman's diary? Elsasser says, television and the internet have taken over cinema's ideological functions, which frees the cinema for other purposes and functions. Cinema is not obsolete. Instead, perhaps, it has been liberated. He reminds us that the term obsolescence, after all, belongs to the discourse of capitalism and technology. Might it be, he emphasizes, that culture and art are in the process of usurping industry and technology rather than the other way around, as T.W. Adorno and others predicted and feared? Would TikTok be the obvious contemporary example of this when looking at the widespread social and technological changes taking place because of user-initiated content? I note here another reason to produce a cinematic self-portrait is to preserve. It's an answer to our pathology for self-immortalization through any available technologies. Whatever happened to the portrait studio? What happens when we take a selfie? Everything is more complicated than I had previously thought. I had some kind of mental crash yesterday. It may have had a lot to do with seeing Doug Block's sizzle reel for his documentary concept, Getting Personal, in which he positioned himself as a personal documentary filmmaker having a personal crisis about making any more of his movies. A propellant to seek other first-person filmmakers. I could see a very expensive therapist, I suppose, or compare notes with those who would truly understand, said Block. When artists seek inspiration, they often go back to the source. Painters study the masters, writers reread their favorite authors. For Getting Personal, I talk to fellow filmmakers, said Block. Specifically, he continued, the ones behind many of the best personal documentaries ever made. In the work demo, Doug, too, asks one of my questions. What does it mean to make personal documentaries in an age where everyone, it seems, is sharing their lives with the world? After seeing the demo, I feel like I was outclassed by someone better connected, better funded, and better positioned to make the first documentary about first-person documentaries. He described it all so eloquently. He'd already interviewed over 20 filmmakers, including four who are on my list, including Doug himself. I told him that I would do anything I can to help him and get the project off the ground, but it did make me think about how my project can be different from his. Perhaps I now realize, for me, the pressure came on to not only make something different, but something more personally coherent and to my liking. When Doug said he interviewed specifically the ones behind many of the best personal documentaries ever made, is he aware that he's inadvertently creating a canon? I'm not suggesting that the people he interviewed are not deserving to be acknowledged, but just the act of grouping necessarily excludes others. His film focuses on the New York East Coast community of filmmakers, while mine will have to prioritize localized regional histories of first-person films from a practice of situated autoethnography. Could my world truly include the likes of Bo Burnham or Wim Wenders? Is it best to dig deeper around me, around here, to see what I find where I live, betting on its inevitable global connections? Max Mueller is still interested in coming to Peterborough. Rob Viscardis shared his progress with his own first-person film this week. Maybe the local meets global, and the project is a never-ending, self-revising notebook on cinematic self-inscription, a hypertext web series with a That's Hollywood style of presentation to legitimize the genre. On personal documentaries, filmmaker Chico Colvard is quoted in Block's demo as saying, "Now that I know how much it requires, I'm even more terrified of venturing back down that rabbit hole." I remember my reluctance at first to jump into the project to produce Birthmark. I think at that time, the other contender was my concept for Hello, My Name Is. Although I don't think it was a personal documentary idea at the time. When I think about making a personal documentary now, I feel burnt out. I've watched many first-person documentaries in the last couple of days. I'm exhausted. After seeing Doug's demo, I realized that I may have just one more me movie inside of me left. It would have to be the one that takes advantage of footage dating back to the 80s and my superior editing skills. There is nothing like seeing a life grow old in front of you on screen as compressed by a well-composed documentary. Yesterday, seeing No Bears was a revelation. It is a fiction film that uses reality for its material. In many ways, it's similar to David Holtzman's diary in the way it fashions its media without the first-person singular, but from traditional cinematic lens. What can I learn from No Bears to do in a film without cheating? As I once said in an essay where I should really say, without being artificially set up. The lens on the filmmaker slash subject in Birthmark maintains the same distance. For the film, I remember Rob Viscardis suggesting that I talk directly at the camera to address the audience, but I balked. I treated myself, my world, and my life as plot and character in my own film, and cast myself to play the role, not unlike what Jafar Panahi does in No Bears. In a Criterion Channel interview, filmmaker Ramin Barani calls Panahi's film a fantasy. It's fact and fantasy combined. No Bears is a film within a film that mirrors the real life masquerading as fiction. With meticulously choreographed long takes and a delicate subtlety in its treatment of the politics, which is the blood that pumps through the heart of the film. In addition, the story is compelling through the scene-by-scene reinvention of one cinematic rule: delay the release of information to the audience. Parse out the details slowly, one at a time. No Bears is a clear window into a complex world created in secret by a master filmmaker. Including a film within a film could be the way to improve on what I did with Birthmark, and perhaps a worthwhile treatment for Doug Block's Getting Personal or Me Movie. In particular, the visual zooming out of screens to reveal other screens would work well for a film about a director making a film. I remember now that I tried a similar technique with the Gold Rushes, except for I wanted to add the twist that one of the nested films within its structure was a musical. Experimental and personal documentary filmmaking. I saw an ad for it on Facebook. I need to screen record that for the director's notebook. You're listening to Synesthesia, produced live in the studio at Trent Radio 92.7 CFFF FM in beautiful Nagajiwinang, Peterborough, Ontario, every Thursday at 5 p.m. It's also a podcast on Soundproof, creative nonfiction for audio. I'm your producer and host, L.A. Alfonso. In this audio program, film theory meets film music. Check the show notes for links to more stuff and how to stay in touch. Today's music playlist includes the work of William Tyler, music from First Cow, Mark Junker, Prepared Piano 1.0, Oliver Patrice Weeder, The Shoe Factory, and the Dust Brothers, music from Fight Club. Check the show notes for links. The Passion Test says, when you have a sense of destiny, it will lead you to where you need to go. I apply this thought to the Me Movie project, and I am drawn to try to remember when the idea first came. I had made a couple of different trailers for a movie that had yet to exist. One of the fake trailers landed me a job with an agency doing work for the Nickelodeon channel in Asia. They were doing a series of short interstitials, content to place in between shows that nurtured the brand, a series called Me TV. Did you know that one of our projects is called Me TV when you put your trailer for a Me movie on your demo reel? I said, no. The truth was, I did not have a lot of experience to put on a reel to sell myself as a director, so I made up content. I don't know where the idea for Illegal Pictures came from. Maybe it was because I stole the music by Dust Brothers from the soundtrack to Fight Club. In one shot, I wore the yellow Yankees beanie that my daughter Georgia has since adopted. I also included flashes of the pot of mung beans that I was boiling. I think I was trying to speak like a poet with sounds and images and layers of meaning on a screen instead of a page. After hours of watching television, I wanted to control, rearrange, slow down, speed up, collect, rewatch, and cite the videos that washed over me. TV pummeled at me with the speed of Peter Mettler's televinetry. I wanted to halt the rapid fire and allow myself to gaze at just one image for a while and let the different meanings peel away even as it stays unmoving. Undressed only by my look, I watch the signifying layers drop to reveal yet another. Thank you. Yeah. Maybe it's a sign. I turned the book at a random page and there it was. The heading says the art of doing field work and to others. I've been struggling in my head lately. I've been trying to figure out a plan and a plan of action for my PhD work, and I've started thinking that I need an advisory board. Of course, I've already started the work of the web series, but since I've officially re-entered the field, I've been meeting other filmmakers working on first-person films. And I've been inspired by meeting them, actually, and I've been heartened and excited to invite them to show and tell about their films for a screening series I want to set up at Sadler House to help conduct the official field work that I've chosen and committed to. The amount of emotional work involved has been unexpected and has made me shrink back a little bit. Unanswered emails bother me. The financial toll of creating a little mini film festival is also more than a scholarship and a student loan can really afford, especially for the final 3 months of the school year. I need a summer job, but how can I do all the work? If I pursue creating a business out of the screening series and start a film festival, will the work be overwhelming and all-consuming? I opened the Handbook of Arts-Based Research randomly this morning to the chapter called The Art of Autoethnography, and this quote popped out. Ethnographers approach the work of describing what it means to be human by first entering a field of experience. Example, identifying and gaining access to a culture of shared practices, identities, or experiences. Establishing a rapport with the community members and participating in and observing social life. Ethnographers do fieldwork by meeting and talking with others, especially key informants, members who occupy privileged roles within a group or who have lived through important experiences, taking field notes, determining key artifacts, creating thick descriptions of their experiences and observations. Meeting Doug Block, a key informant in the world of first-person films, was a godsend. Meeting the filmmakers at the Personal Documentary Filmmakers Call was also exciting, but getting the follow-up emails inboxed felt overwhelming. I have not responded to the emails and I feel stressed because of it. I was open at the meeting and told everyone that I was doing a PhD level research on this topic and everyone on the call could be included. Ethnographers must also consider how to identify themselves as researchers in particular communities, says the authors Adams and Jones in the section on related relational ethics. Relating care and respect. They urge to also consider whether and how they might share their observations with and seek feedback from community members and decide what to include, what information to leave out. They say the complexities that arise in autoethnography's blurring of fieldwork and life, inside and outside, past and present, underscores the importance of attending to the relational ethics and aesthetics of fieldwork. With autoethnography, fieldwork is a blurry concept because much of the autoethnographer's personal experience can serve as a possible relevant insider sources of data. Reading all of this has affirmed for me that I am on the right track. The work I'm doing is autoethnography, of course, and not a survey of dusty old books and films. Therefore, the research necessarily involves all of these relational and financial aspects. The Shirk Grant would have been really helpful. Yet, there is no denying that I'm already doing the work, and if I were to assess my own progress right now, I would still say that I'm still an A-plus student. What lesson is this? The book tells me emphatically today that this is the way for me to use and hone my skills with life writing for the good and abundance of all. My concern with a possible issue with the ethics board is addressed in this quote. Understanding relational ethics of autoethnography must be understood on the continuum of ethnography and life writing. Some research review boards require ethnographers to seek permission from the people they interview, yet these same review boards do not always require life writers, especially fiction writers, to seek permission from the people about whom they write. To expect all autoethnographers to seek permission from the people possibly implicated in a project is an inappropriate and uninformed requirement. The authors offer the idea of using techniques associated with fiction and creating composite characters as a solution to balance story needs and relational ethics. Although we may implicate others in our stories and may sometimes want or need to tell others when this occurs, others should not have the ability to control our silence or silence us from offering our interpretations of personal experience. The paper quotes John Van Manen, who describes ethnographic literary tales as those that consist of scene-by-scene reconstructions of dramatic and mundane events, extensive use of dialogue and monologue to establish character, direct representations of the character's emotional and subjective points of view, strong storylines organized around themes of general social interest, and explicit claims made by the author for the transparency and immediacy of the writing. Adams and Jones define the art of autoethnography as an approach to doing and representing social research that uses personal, auto, experience to create a representation, graphy, of cultural, ethno, experiences, social expectations, and shared beliefs, values, and practices. It combines the aims and practices of ethnography with the aims and practices of life writing. One challenge of autoethnography is being able to artfully arrange life in ways that enable readers to enter into dialogue with our lives as well as with their understanding of their own. Artfully arranging life means telling stories that reflect on past events, that take on difficult experiences and dissonant selves, and that provide the reader with a sense of movement and transformation. The authors quote A.P. Bochner, who says, "I prefer narratives that express the tale of two selves, a believable journey from who I was to who I am, a life course reimagined or transformed by crisis." A quote from Mary Carr offers similar advice, noting that you'll need both sides of yourself, the beautiful and the beastly, to hold a reader's attention, and that a writer's struggling psyche fuels the tale. The above quote can be used for a rubric for first-person films as well, and it reminds me that I must note every mental and emotional struggle I have because, as Carr says, it's fuel for the story. The authors open their essential chapter on this research method with a beautiful excerpt from the work of Matthew Gulish. "A work is an object overflowing its frame. Work is an event in which a human participates. The human is an organism that works. A work works when it becomes an event of work. We do not need to find a way into work since our work since the work is already inside. Instead, we realize a work and its harmony with our point of view. Then, it and we begin to work, and the play begins. The authors reiterate, a work is not a thing, an object, but an event that exceeds a very notion of art. A work is an event because it is made through human action and experience. We bring ourselves, our pasts, presents, opinions, ideas to the work, and these histories and points of view shape our prescriptions and responses. We are inside everything. We experience and create. We do not need to find a way into the work of art because we are already inside, already in tune and in play. Integral to our writing and our relationships with others, they say, what Ghoulish teaches us about the art of research is that the work of research is the work of life. And the work of writing the events of our human experience as they overflow their frames from the inside out. I'm really glad that page showed itself to me this morning. I wake up. I read a chapter in Amateur Filmmaking by Max Schlesser called Towards Mobile Filmmaking 2.0. And I feel changed by the realization it inspired. The Me Movie web series would necessarily have to be shot with my iPhone. The true director's notebook in my real life. As a practical aesthetic and ideological choice. This way I can differentiate myself from Doug Block's Getting Personal. I am not trying to professionally produce a festival-worthy or fit-for-a-specialty channel feature documentary, but an ad hoc, self-revising, ongoing compendium of notes towards a film about first-person cinema that exists on its own context. In the paper, Schlesser writes about how in 1938, professional documentary filmmakers ignored the 16mm format, which was associated with the private sphere and was therefore deemed inappropriate for public sphere or public education in the style of Grierson. He quotes author Brian Winston, who argues that it was attitude, not technology, which held 16mm back professionally in the 30s. However, some agitprop groups and ethnographers called attention to the format and proclaimed the 16mm camera in the right hands is no toy. Even as early as 2007, Jeffrey Bardzell was already pointing to the aesthetic maturation of amateur multimedia and mentions video podcasts in particular. Writing from 2023, by reading this paper, I'm confronted by my own bias against using the handy, readily available iPhone with which to create a certain caliber of content. Why not use all the tools at my disposal? According to Bardzell, creativity is an act of discovering and extending the hidden logic of technological media forms. Amateur YouTube videos, he says, are not cinematic and often not even narrative. It's the birth of a major new non-narrative genre of film, perhaps the first since the documentary. Judy Hetrick uses the term vernacular video as a more precise category to describe nonfiction videos made by untrained camera operators who attempt to realistically reflect life around them. Mobile filmmaking results in a different kind of video product. To understand mobile video projects, it is important to evaluate them in a category of their own. An alternative space for the creation of artwork has emerged, says Schlesser. In her 1965 article, Amateur versus Professional, filmmaker Maya Deren reminds the reader the very word amateur, from the Latin lover, means one who does something for the love of the thing rather than for economic reasons or necessity. She writes, "The amateur has one great advantage which all professionals envy him, freedom, both artistic and physical." Deren says, "The most important part of your equipment is yourself, your mobile body, your imaginative mind, your freedom to use both." In 2023, the distinction between industry and amateur is sometimes difficult to tell, but in users becoming content producers, Schlesser notes, it is pertinent to consider the question of users contributing to the creation of new cinematic forms. Schlesser notes that it was Canadian documentary filmmaker Peter Wintonik who introduced the conceptual model of the pro-do-user in a masterclass which relates to the blurring roles of the user and producer. Maya Deren says, physical freedom includes time freedom, a freedom from budget-imposed deadlines. But above all, the amateur filmmaker with his small, lightweight equipment has an inconspicuous for candid shooting and a physical mobility which is, well, the envy of most professionals, burdened as they are by their many-ton monsters, cables, and crews. She emphasizes that the human body is better than any tripod, yet invented, with its ability to be versatile and makes possible the enormous variety of camera angles and visual action. Schlesser writes, so-called amateurs are less concerned with applying filmic conventions, standardized filmic languages, and filmic grammar through this freedom. They have capacities to create new practices that are set free from these constraints. Mobile media users, says Schlesser, are not only creating stories, but are also contributing to the formation of a new aesthetics and innovation in the field of documentary filmmaking. You're listening to Synesthesia, produced live in the studio at Trent Radio 92.7 CFFF FM in beautiful Nagajiwanong, Peterborough, Ontario, every Thursday at 5 p.m. It's also a podcast on Soundproof, creative nonfiction for audio. I'm your producer and host, L.A. Alfonso. In this audio program, film theory meets film music. Check the show notes for links to more stuff and how to stay in touch. I'll be back next week for the final episode of the season. I'm L.A. Alfonso. Thanks for listening.